You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. Look for us on Twitter and Facebook by searching for The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And in the end, it wasn't even close. The people of Crimea voted overwhelmingly yesterday to rejoin Russia. The referendum is over. Now it's up to the international community and the people of Ukraine to decide what to do about it. This hour, a look at the options. Also, we'll have a discussion of the persistent mystery of that Malaysian jetliner now being sought over land in Central Asia after some troubling details emerged over the weekend. Persistent controversy distracts the celebrations of St. Patrick's Day in New York and Boston. The question of family preservation in child custody cases down in Florida ends up putting some children at risk. And we'll have the harrowing story of a single mom facing persistent poverty. A young woman from Tennessee tells us the story of 42 million women on the brink of poverty in America. But we begin with the persistent mystery surrounding Malaysian Airlines Flight 370, that has put new scrutiny on civil aviation monitoring systems globally and those that are the responsibility of individual nations like Malaysia. It appears that nearly every detail now emerging in the investigation of the disappearance more than a week ago of the Boeing 777 points to a deliberate act of concealment and diversion by an individual or individuals with sophisticated knowledge of the communication systems on board a jetliner. Whoever was responsible for disabling 370's signaling systems seems to have understood that a blind spot could be created in the skies. Now the rest of the world seems to understand that something about an international blind spot that we didn't know before is emerging. Joining us is aviation security analyst Chris Yates, joining us from the UK. Mr. Yates, welcome to the program.
Hello, John.
Would you say there is a blind spot and that countermeasures possibly engineered from within an airplane could make a jetliner, a 777, invisible?
Well, essentially, this airplane became a hole in the sky immediately that the systems that identify it were turned off aboard. So quite clearly, there is a significant issue here that has effectively blindsided the investigators looking into the disappearance of this airplane.
Why would such signaling systems even be turn-offable, to use a bad bit of phrasing there? But why would you ever be able to negate them?
Well, there's a very good reason for negating or turning off any of the technology that's on board an airplane, and that is for pure safety reasons. If, for example, a fire took hold in one bit of the circuitry, and then essentially you'd have to immediately terminate all power to that part of the system to help to contain the fire. So all of the systems on board an aircraft can be turned off individually, separately, in the event of such an incident.
But based on your understanding of the technology, to do something like that would understandably arouse suspicion on the part of the crew. It's not something you could quietly do while no one was looking, yes?
It's not something that can quietly be done, so it has to have been done deliberately. The Malaysian Prime Minister said as much on Saturday when he made his dramatic announcement that first the ACARS system, the data transfer, if you will, between the aircraft and ground had been deliberately turned off, and subsequently the transponder system was turned off. And therein lies a debate. Why on earth do you need to do that? Why on earth was it done? And what happened to the aircraft thereafter?
Is there something about the way the Malaysians have dealt with this investigation that makes you suspect that maybe their security protocols aren't up to snuff here? Or is it something about the unprecedented nature of turning off these systems that would constitute a kind of stealth, that basically, because no one would do such a thing, you wouldn't notice it?
There is something, at least suspect, in the Malaysian handling of the situation, in so much as, you know, when the aircraft was flying, once the systems had been turned off, then one imagines that the military most certainly would have had a track on the aircraft to identify where it was going. In other words, a primary radar return from the aircraft to indicate that it was still airborne and going in entirely a different direction. And that should have raised a warning bell that something was awry. And then Ultimately, of course, the fighter jet should have been lofted, and the ultimate step taken of shooting the aircraft down if it wasn't responding. That is the sequence of events that has been in place, a process that's been in place since 9/11 amongst all countries in the world. If you have a jet flying toward you at a rate of knots with no apparent person in control, it is shot down.
Now, that was the expectation, though, on 9/11, even on some level, certainly for lay people, that you don't just invade someone's airspace without there being some kind of a response. Is it possible that there are just so many planes in the air at any given moment that the ability to actually sort out the signal from the noise is very, very difficult, and that you can't expect to immediately scramble fighter jets without the risk of some error?
Well, that is a possibility, of course, but more than likely, and the failure here might well be down to Malaysia's control of the airspace in a military fashion. In other words, was somebody actually looking at the radar screens at the time? Were they actually paying any due attention to anything that was coming at them? Or was it just a case that something like this hasn't happened before? It's not probably not going to happen. So why do I, as a radar person, need to pay any attention at all times?
Speaking to us from the UK, Chris Yates is an aviation security analyst. Now, as the notion of a deliberate act here gathers currency, the options for that plane would have been to land somewhere if there was someone actually in control of it. What is the chance that you could bring a Boeing 777 down somewhere and not be detected?
Well, yeah, that's one assumption. The other assumption, of course, is that the co-pilot might well, or the pilot might well, have been intent on committing suicide and taking the plane and all of its passengers with him. We simply don't know at the moment the whereabouts of the plane. And because of that, the search continues as to the possible location, whether it be on a runway somewhere, which I happen to think it isn't, by the way, or whether indeed it has crashed into either jungle or at sea. And of the two, I come down on the latter.
Chris Yates is an aviation security analyst. We want to bring in someone who was asking precisely the questions of what would the options have been for a plane flying more than a week ago in that part of the world to actually come down without crashing. Noah Veltman is developer and journalist with the WNYC Data News Team. Now, you've published, Noah, first of all, welcome.
Hi, John.
You've published a map that shows all of the actual available runways, official runways, that were of a length sufficient to allow a 777 to land. How many options, official options, did that plane have at the moment that it was flying?
We found 634 runways that, with an aggressive estimate, were long enough to land a 777 and were also within the range that, as of Friday, people were estimating it could have continued flying from the point it was last spotted.
People have shared this information all over the world, partly as a way of asking themselves questions of what might have caused this plane to disappear. Where could it have ended up? Isn't it the case, though, that these 600 or so options are precisely the ones we now must rule out? Because if it came down at an actual official airstrip, someone would have noticed and reported it.
Well, that's certainly another aspect of the data that you have to consider, is most of these runways are at large international airports or at the sort of airstrip that you're never going to land a 777 without people seeing it. But it's not necessarily the case for all of them. Many of them are in remote areas, and so it's one of many things we just wouldn't know.
Chris Yates, bearing in mind that you just said that your assumption is that this plane was probably brought down deliberately and not on an airstrip, looking at that map of Noah Veltman, can you rule out all those little red dots as a possible destination for this plane, flight to 370?
No, I don't think anybody can rule out any aspect of the investigation thus far. It's possible, of course, that it has been brought down on a runway somewhere, possibly somewhere very remote, and that the passengers are being held hostage, but then there's been no claim of responsibility. And therefore, that leads me to believe that this is not a prospect that's going to, or an event that is going to end happily at all.
Chris Yates, finally, before we go, is there the chance that a pilot without instruments could bring down a 777 on a six-lane highway somewhere completely off the radar, quite literally?
No, is the short answer. The likelihood of it being brought down on a six-lane highway, assuming there was a six-lane highway anywhere around that part of the world, is quite remote, to say the least.
Chris Yates is an aviation security analyst who spoke with us from the UK. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Also, thanks to Noah Veltman, developer and journalist with the WNYC Data News team. You can see the map that they created of all of the official runway options for Flight 370 at thetakeaway.org. Noah, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Later this hour, economic security will be our focus, particularly the lack of security for millions of people trying to stave off poverty, making minimum wage, raising kids, and doing it all alone.
It's an everyday struggle. You got to pick and choose what you're going to pay, what you have to have. It's just, it's struggling. It's hard. It's two paychecks in a month. You get paid every 2 weeks. About $650, and most of that's gone at the end of the month, except for gas money, some money for food, but it's mostly just gone, all the bills.
Later this hour, we'll hear firsthand the story of surviving on the edge of poverty from struggling mom Katrina Gilbert and filmmaker Sherry Cookson from the new HBO documentary Paycheck to Paycheck. That's an experience, paycheck to paycheck, for an estimated 42 million women, and more broadly, for at least 44% of all Americans, according to the latest economic data, living at such a low level of economic security that it is difficult to look beyond immediate needs and to plan ahead financially in any way. We'd love to hear your experience. Is that your predicament? You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. How do you get by? How many paychecks do you have each month? How do you sort out the priorities? Tweet us at The Takeaway. You can also react to anything you hear on the program at facebook.com/TheTakeaway or at our website, thetakeaway.org, where, as I said, you can see that map of Asian runways potentially open to whomever was flying Malaysian Flight 370 more than a week ago. You can also rehear any segment, catch up on past shows, check out our daily podcast. You can download it at thetakeaway.org.
Listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Using the tools of democracy, there is an initiative underway to attempt to roll back history, starting with that vote in Crimea over the weekend. In 1954, Soviet premier and successor to dictator Joseph Stalin, Nikita Khrushchev, made the land called Crimea part of the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. A bit of a detail in those days, as both Ukraine and Crimea were then part of the Soviet Union. But when the Soviet Union dissolved in 1991, Crimea and its Russian-majority population stayed with Ukraine. Now, is that map drawn by a Soviet leader changing, and can this overwhelmingly pro-Russian referendum in Crimea, along with the presence of Russian troops there, reverse a half-century of history? We spoke with Nina Khrushcheva, professor of international affairs at the New School in New York, and Ukrainian politician Oleh Rybachuk, former deputy prime minister in Kiev, where he says the people of Ukraine today are collectively saying, what now?
I've just met in my office first refugees from Crimea. They just packed in 2 hours, came here, and I was mostly preoccupied with their status because they honestly don't know to do whom to call. They don't understand what's going on. They clearly expected this so-called referendum was predictable. So the society is, I would say, in shocked and waiting position.
Nina Khrushcheva, you are the great-granddaughter of Nikita Khrushchev, who actually changed the map, putting Crimea in the Ukrainian sort of domain. What do you think this represents, this referendum over the weekend?
Well, first of all, if I may correct, you called Nikita Khrushchev dictator. Stalin was dictator. Nikita Khrushchev was a communist, authoritarian, or autocrat. I think what it represents is that Vladimir Putin would like to take over parts of the former Soviet Union that he thinks he can possess. And Crimea seemed to be the easiest part that he could take. But you already had this precedent in Georgia in 2008. There were two other parts taken out of Georgia, Abkhazia and South Ossetia. Now it is Crimea. There are areas in Moldova, another republic. Really, what he's trying to do is that what people like Nikita Khrushchev, who was not a dictator but an autocrat, and tried to decentralize the communist monolith as much as he could in the Soviet times.
Let's talk about that distinction.
Wants to take it back.
Do you think Putin fancies himself more of a dictator like Joseph Stalin or more of a communist autocrat like your great-grandfather?
I think Putin fancies himself as the savior of the Russian people. I don't think he has a particular model in mind that is just one Joseph Stalin. I think what is really very important to understand about him, he sees himself as those imperial uniters of the Russian past. First it was Ivan the Terrible, Peter the Great, Joseph Stalin, those with a strong hand added to the Russian greatness. He really feels that he is the great Russian leader.
Oleh Rybachuk in Kiev, do you think the people of Ukraine now expect that Putin will ask the Duma in Moscow to confirm this vote? And that if there are no sanctions coming from the West, what would be the reaction in Kiev?
Well, sanctions are there, and I can't imagine how the world may swallow this, because this is the challenge to the global security system. I just came from Strasbourg, where I was addressing European parliaments and talking to EU about their soft power, about the role of European Union, and the purpose of other countries like Ukraine signing agreements and going on their way to reforms, if there is one guy who will show to the rest of the world that this is all irrelevant. So this is really a global challenge, and we can't pretend that this is a minor, because if you look at the map, we will realize this. As for the Putin's next steps, we have to admit that Putin is now disappointed. He wanted to be a peacekeeper, where he will bring Russian peace keepers at the request of fighting Ukrainians. He expected to have civil war provoked in Ukraine and conflict between Russian-speaking Ukrainians and actually Ukrainian-speaking Ukrainians, which did not happen. He wanted to see the whole country in the middle of that crisis. Therefore, thousands of Russian tourists now try to provoke conflicts in southern and eastern Ukraine, but they are not to the scale where Putin can say that the country is on the edge of civil war. This is not happening.
Former Deputy Prime Minister of the Ukraine, Oleh Rybachuk, speaking from Kiev. Finally, before we go, Nina Khrushcheva, great-granddaughter of Nikita Khrushchev, professor of international affairs at the New School in New York. Do you think that the people of Crimea have handed Vladimir Putin a problem or a gift here? And is there anything that the international community can do about it?
I think eventually it's going to be a problem, if not very soon, because, first of all, I don't think I agree with Mr. Rybachuk that Putin didn't expect the outcome of this, not so much even that he couldn't create a real civil war, but also he did not expect the outcry of an international community, because he really is very quickly becoming an international pariah. So very soon, Crimea would become a problem. He got himself a little territory, but at the same time, he may have lost Ukraine or influence in world affairs. So that is one point. And another point is that I think Crimeans very soon would understand that they were opting, with their 97% voting for him, they were opting to be part of the great country. But if Russia is not a great country anymore, but an international pariah, what it is were they voting for?
Nina Khrushcheva, great-granddaughter of Nikita Khrushchev, professor of international affairs at the New School in New York. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Also, our thanks to Ukrainian politician Oleh Rybachuk, speaking from Kiev. What do you think? Is Crimea back home, if not in the USSR, then in Russia as a result of this vote over the weekend? 97% voting to go with Russia on this question. Some immediate sanctions have already been imposed selectively on Russian officials and some institutions. The question of recognizing this Crimean vote remains open. The West has pledged no recognition. Russia has yet to officially move. And so far, the details of any possible handover of Crimea to Russia that would involve discussion of water, electricity, and other energy systems, all those details have yet to be worked out. There haven't even been discussions between the two. What do you think? Should there be a Western response? Roman from Brooklyn told us that Crimea's vote pushes the region farther from Europe and closer to Russia. No one wants to live under Putin's Russia, Roman says. You can reach us at thetakeaway.org or call us with your reaction at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. Later in the hour, we'll be examining violence against young children and the state of child welfare in Florida. This is The Takeaway. The religious holiday commemorating a Catholic saint, St. Patrick's Day, long ago became a national celebration for the people of Ireland, especially those Irish who live outside of the homeland where St. Paddy reportedly worked his miracles. National messages of Irish pride, Irish politics, and other political messages have become part of the celebrations. But the message that gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgenders are not welcome by parade organizers in Boston and New York City has made those parades politically sensitive. The mayor of Boston didn't march in that city's day parade yesterday. New York's mayor, Bill de Blasio, turned down an invitation in solidarity with the LGBT movement. He's the first mayor in 20 years not to attend New York's parade. And the boycott now includes the Irish government. Joan Burton is Ireland's Minister for Social Protection.
I think Ireland has changed a lot, and the St. Patrick's Day parade in New York is a great fun day. I would just like to see everybody included. It's a great tradition in Ireland. It's an even longer and bigger tradition in New York, and I would love to be involved, but to see it including everybody.
Is it the official position of the nation of Ireland that the St. Patrick's Day parade is not sanctioned by Ireland as a celebration of Irish tradition?
No, the parade is a celebration of Irish tradition, but Irish tradition includes tradition around people who are gay or lesbian or transgender. They're very much part of the Irish story too. I think Irish people admire the St. Patrick's Day parade. It's a private parade, of course, so it's up to the organisers to arrange their private parade. But I think most people in Ireland, as with our own parades in Ireland, would like to see it as a demonstration of inclusiveness and all the best in Ireland, both our history, but also that on St. Patrick's Day, it's a fun day to be Irish. It's a great day to celebrate all of the contribution that Ireland has made to America down the centuries.
I notice you said this is a private parade, and given that some have also suggested that the tradition of the St. Patrick's Day parade in New York is sometimes a seeming celebration of drunkenness and lawlessness. If there's an attempt by Ireland to distance itself from this celebration as it manifests itself in the United States on all levels.
I would say there's a long-running love affair between people in Ireland and the United States and the shared history and shared events. Particularly recently last year, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the death of John F. Kennedy, a great American, but a great Irish American. So I think that in Ireland, we look to the United States and we welcome huge numbers of both American companies and American visitors, people looking for their roots. Ireland nowadays is a much more diverse place, and we would just carry, and I would just carry that approach of ordinary Irish people to the parade.
So then is the message from Ireland, officially or otherwise, on some level, that the St. Patrick's Day parade, as it currently is conducted in New York, is out of the Irish mainstream, and that New Yorkers should maybe get back to the center?
Well, our Taoiseach, who's the Prime Minister of Ireland, will be in New York on St. Patrick's Day, and I think he'll be celebrating with the parade, and that's his choice. As I said, I was very happy to be in New York 2 years ago. I felt at that time that there were very positive indications that everybody would be included. I was quite disappointed, really, to find that not very much, if any, progress had been made for more inclusion. And I decided this time to pass until it was more inclusive. You know, social understandings change over a period of time. And as I say, particularly in Ireland, we would like to see ourselves as an inclusive and welcoming place for everybody, just like America.
Joan Burton is Ireland's Minister for Social Protection. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
An environmental story is the subject of this week's Retro Report Look Back. Back in the early 1980s, the multi-billion dollar California agriculture industry witnessed an assault by the arrival of the Mediterranean fruit fly. The feds and then Governor Jerry Brown met the infestation with an unprecedented statewide quarantine.
We are prepared and indeed intend to entirely quarantine the state of California.
The decision of the United States Department of Agriculture leaves California with no alternative. We're being forced into aerial spraying.
Today, an army of state employees went door to door to warn residents to stay inside when the aerial spraying begins.
The pesticide malathion was eventually sprayed from aircraft and raised the level of hysteria in the state of California and was unpopular with everyone except farmers.
And many have been scared by scientists who say malathion causes cancer, confused by others who say it does not.
We feel like we are just trapped here and we're going to be sprayed. We're going to be living in the sea of malathion.
I could have a 2-pound baby instead of a nice, healthy 7-pound baby.
Decades later, so much is different now, including an altered awareness of the threat of migrating pests of all kinds. One thing that hasn't changed, though, the governor back then, Jerry Brown, is also the governor today. Joshua Fisher, Retro Report producer, joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's pretty interesting looking back. I mean, first of all, let's talk about the players. We'll get to Jerry Brown in a moment. What is the state of the medfly in California?
Well, the medfly is back. It's not. It doesn't show up every year, but since 1990, it has been detected in all but 4 years. So it's still around. It pops up.
And it's been coexisting with the people of California, at least as far as you were able to determine. Listen.
They're really established throughout the state. There's absolutely no question. But they're very low populations. And so what the state has done is really suppress them, but they haven't contained them.
That's a UC Davis professor, James Carey. Is this a solution?
Well, what the state does is when the medfly shows up, they respond with an eradication program. And what scientists like James Carey argue is that that's kind of a reactive approach. And what the state needs to do is look at the data as he's done, draw a bigger pattern and realize that the medfly is established. It's there. It's a permanent resident. It's not always being brought back into the state from tourists coming in with infested fruit. So they need to come up with a long-term plan to deal with the pest and not just always react.
Meanwhile, one of the lessons of your Retro Report is that in California, at least back in the 1980s, agriculture ended up trumping environmental concerns. Listen.
California agriculture is an almost $40 billion business. So we have to work very closely with trading partners to establish that California is, in fact, free of the Mediterranean fruit fly.
And Californians buy that view, right? Pretty much?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, these days, no one really thinks too much about the medfly. It was a big news story back then, but that was primarily because all of the controversy over malathion spraying. Today, they don't spray malathion from the air anymore.
He was governor then. He's governor today. Here's then California Governor Jerry Brown.
I've got to weigh the health effects, and the impact on people.
I'm wondering if in the decisions today of Jerry Brown to support fracking in the state of California and to declare a drought emergency, if on some level he's really thinking back to his experience in the 1980s with the medfly.
It certainly was a not a high point, probably a low point of his first term as governor, and it made a big impact. And so I'm sure, even though he doesn't talk too much about the Medfly today, I'm sure it informs everything he does.
Well, it certainly taught him lessons about political risks and the risks of not being decisive and aggressive and being only reactive. And we certainly haven't seen much of that from Governor Brown this time around. Fascinating stuff. Joshua, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Joshua Brown's retro report is on the Medfly controversy back in the 1980s. Joshua Fisher works for a Retro Report, a service of our partners, the New York Times. Thanks.
Thank you.
Impulse to protect families in child custody cases seems to have put some children at risk in the state of Florida. A story in the Miami Herald newspaper that couldn't be more tragic. The Herald documents the Florida Department of Children and Families' history of losing children in domestic situations that were understood to be risky. At least 477 deaths at the hands of people in homes that already had been investigated by the state. Preventable deaths, 477 kids who did not need to die, betrayed by the state agency, ostensibly charged with their protection. Joining us on the line is one of the reporters on the Miami Herald series, Carol Marvin Miller, an investigative reporter for the award-winning newspaper, the Miami Herald. Carol, welcome.
Thank you.
So how did you suspect there was a pattern here that called for a full-scale investigation?
Well, we've been writing about child welfare at the Herald for a long, long time. I have. And we've written about these cases as they arise as breaking news. And there has been really a sad procession of children who perished after the state child protection agency had at least one opportunity to intervene meaningfully. And we wanted not to address this issue piecemeal. At some point, we wanted to take a deep dive and to better understand what the patterns were and what needed to be done to fix it.
And share some of the details of the individual cases that are actually quite upsetting.
There are two cases that interested me a great deal because they looked so similar, although they occurred 5 years apart. In 2008, a baby by the name of Kyla Joy Hall was killed by her father. Kyla had ended up in the hospital with a skull fracture and some other injuries that the State Child Protection Team, which is a group of doctors that evaluate children for evidence of abuse, determined to be inflicted. At first, the Child Protection Agency removed Kyla from her parents, but at some point the mother surrendered her rights, and the agency inexplicably gave this baby back to her father, who was a firefighter in Jacksonville. And in short order, Kyla ended up back in the hospital, this time with a ruptured heart and a, quote, pulpified, end quote, liver. Kyla died. And, of course, there was the perfunctory review of what went wrong. 5 years later, in the fall of 2013, another newborn by the name of Logan Hancock ended up in the emergency room with a cracked skull that also was determined to be the result of inflicted abuse. It was a depressed skull fracture, which usually occurs when someone uses blunt force on a child's head. And once again, they decided to terminate the parents' rights, but changed their minds quickly and inexplicably. The child was returned, and within a couple of weeks was back in the hospital with yet another skull fracture, this time fatal. It appears that over a long period of time, they don't seem to learn from mistakes, though they study them.
I mean, that is just so upsetting to hear you dispassionately recount that, and I know it's upsetting to you as a parent. How does the agency seem to have a strategy of defaulting to preserving the family in these cases when workers on the ground believe that these young kids, infants in some cases, are at risk?
Well, beginning about 10 years ago, Florida Child Welfare Administrators implemented a very vigorous, very intensive program of what's called family preservation. Family preservation is sound public policy, and it is codified in federal law. You have to make reasonable efforts to keep children with their families when you suspect abuse or neglect. Federal law and state law in Florida say that you do not need to make those reasonable efforts when there has been evidence of egregious abuse or when, say, a chronic addiction renders a parent unfit. But in Florida, we clung to an almost unforgiving type of family preservation over a decade, even when the evidence mounted that this was not sound public policy, because what we did in Florida was we kept children in these very, very dangerous homes, but we didn't implement services in those homes to mitigate risk. We didn't have the resources. And so we were leaving children with dangerous parents with no safety net. And what we reported Sunday was the consequence of that was that child deaths increased dramatically, particularly with regard to small children, infants and toddlers, who had no ability to protect themselves.
How did you discover that the way of categorizing some of these fatalities allowed the state agency responsible for these kids to really cover their tracks, to make it look like they had a much better record than they in fact did?
Well, that's the issue that we're going to be reporting on in next Sunday's story, but to give you a preview of coming attractions, there are two things that they have done, and these things are very well documented. Number one, they allow death investigations to remain open or pending for a long, long time. There were two little girls who were killed here in Miami by their stepfather, and it was a horrible, horrible death. They were strangled. One of them was raped. They were left in a closet to molder until they were found. The mother was killed as well. That case remained open for 2 years until we asked the administrator about it, and within a week of our asking, miraculously it was closed and the death review became available to us. There are probably a couple of dozen child deaths that remain pending in Miami, and they have for a long time, and so those cases don't count. The other thing that they did was, beginning around 2010, they redefined what certain types of neglect deaths are. So some drowning deaths and some in-bed smothering deaths, they're called overlays, were now being called simple tragic accidents as opposed to neglect-related deaths. And those didn't count. And so beginning around 2010, it appears as if the number of deaths with priors were declining. But if you look deeply, you'll recognize that that just wasn't the case.
Very, very upsetting story. Carol Marvin Miller is part of the team of investigative reporters for the Miami Herald looking into potentially preventable fatalities at the Florida Department of Children and Families. Thanks so much, Carol.
Thank you very much.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews, now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com.
Young mom Katrina Gilbert says this was one of the hardest moments of her life.
Brooklyn looked at me this morning in the car and she said, "Mommy, you need help." And I was like, "I know I do."
It's also one of the most moving moments in a new HBO documentary, Paycheck to Paycheck, The Life and Times of Katrina Gilbert. It's part of a Maria Shriver multimedia project, The Shriver Report, A Woman's Nation Pushes Back from the Brink. The documentaries and wider reporting in the project attempt to portray the plight of 42 million women in America who are living in poverty or teetering on the brink. A third of them mothers of young children. The numbers say one in three women in America has a story to tell about surviving poverty or keeping it at bay. Katrina Gilbert's story begins with the fact that she is a single mom of three in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Katrina and one of the film's directors, Sherry Cookson, talked to us about the harrowing realities for a woman facing poverty alone on an income of $9.63 an hour and a paycheck of only $650 every 2 weeks.
You have to pay your rent. You have to pay your electric bill. You have to have gas in your car. You have to pay the daycare. Your phone, it can wait. Don't like for it to wait because it's the only thing you have. Kids get sick. Someone's got to get a hold of you. So the phone can wait. We never had cable.
What about cookies for dessert?
No extras. No extras. The kids ask for a candy bar. I can't buy that right now, you know. At points in my life, you know, it was feed them and I wouldn't eat.
So, Sherry, why did Katrina represent a story emblematic of the mission of this entire series that you're involved with on HBO?
We wanted to be able to follow very intimately the story of one woman so that we could really understand how all the daily things when she's living on the brink of poverty and how they all come together. And when we met Katrina, we met her through the daycare center, Chambliss Center for Children, which is, we heard about it, it was a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week, 365-day-a-year facility where women could receive subsidized care for their children, and so they can work whatever shifts they have to work. So we met Katrina there and immediately felt like her genuine, brave self, and that would be touching to an audience, and we could take them on her journey.
Katrina, is the Chambliss Center that Sherry refers to here the center of your community, your sense of family right now?
I think so, yes. If it wasn't for them, then I couldn't work. And I don't know where I would be. I don't know where the kids and I would be. Because I wouldn't be able to afford daycare.
What's it like there? What do your kids think it is? Is it home away from home? Is it camp? Is it school?
All of the above. Because they do so much. They have tennis courts. They have dance classes. They have tons of playgrounds. It's just lots of fun activities for them.
Let's talk a little bit about your job. You are
a certified nursing assistant.
Certified nursing assistant. You work in a facility for the elderly.
Yes.
Let's hear a little bit about, you know, the moment of a typical day in the life of Katrina Gilbert.
Hey, Mr. Behringer. Are you done?
Yes, I am.
You are? You had it all.
Yeah, I put it all away.
Like always. You lift your feet. There you go.
There you go.
Yeah, there you go, bud.
So there you are, very tenderly dealing with Mr. Behringer.
Yes.
And you take care of many elderly people in the course of a day. How do you maintain your sense of compassion for them when you are so clearly struggling economically moment to moment?
Well, I leave my struggles away from work. Like some people that I work with that have seen the film, they've come to me and they've been like, I didn't know that you were actually struggling that much. When I come to work, I take care of my residents. I care for them. I love them. And they're like family to me. I see them every day. I care for them every day.
So how much is this film, do you think, a story of poverty or a story of overcoming?
I do think it's both those things. The struggle and the determination to somehow rise above it, and the trap of sort of getting caught in these circumstances where the money is just so tight that there's always going to be something that's going to come along that's going to make it impossible to move to that next step.
What was the toughest moment in the film that when you see it, you go back to, oh boy, we almost lost all the marbles there?
When the school denied me my financial aid and I couldn't go. That broke me down.
Still does.
Well, not as of last night. They gave me a full scholarship to college.
HBO did?
No. Chattanooga.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So what is school going to mean?
Hope. A way out. Stability. Get a better paying job.
What's the dream? You want to be an RN, LPN, even beyond that, administrator?
I think in more of a business type setting, marketing, advertising, something along those lines. So it's more stable, first shift, Monday through Friday.
How tempted were you watching this unfold to just basically toss, you know, $3,000 on the HBO expense docket and just funnel that to your subject as opposed to sitting there watching her go through these struggles?
I mean, when you're making a documentary film, you know that what you get, you want it to come in a pure kind of a way and not in a way that you feel like, you know, you're paying to get that material. And sometimes when I was making the film, I started thinking about rich and poor and how different things were rich in your life and different things were poor in your life. And, you know, being myself a woman with two kids, and I was out making the film, and I started thinking a lot about the fact that my husband was home with the kids so I could work. And if I didn't have him, I wouldn't be a documentary filmmaker. And if I wasn't a documentary filmmaker, I wouldn't have a profession. If I didn't have a profession, I might not have a paycheck. And so all of the things that you went through all of the time with your kids and the choices that you were making, and I just felt them so deeply, and it changed me. I mean, you were a gift to me, and I thank you for that.
Thank you.
What's the hardest question one of your kids ever asked about the way you guys live?
They've asked, like, in the trailer, like, why can't we move? Why do we have to be, you know, in this small place where they have no room to actually play or anything because it's so small?
What do you hope they say about you when they're all grown up?
I hope they say that they're proud of me and that they realize what I've done for them. I hope they're proud of me.
Katrina Gilbert, subject of the new HBO documentary Paycheck to Paycheck, and Shari Cookson, one of the film's directors. Paycheck to Paycheck debuts tonight on HBO. How does Katrina Gilbert's experience compare with your economic reality? Chris from Columbia, South Carolina says, I get paid twice a month. I try to live simply, yet I cannot afford necessary things. Need a better car, need home repairs, can't get sick because missing one check will send me spiraling into deep debt. I only wish I could get a lump sum to get out of debt, then possibly I could breathe. What would give you breathing room? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or visit us at thetakeaway.org. You can see some video reporting from the Miami Herald's terrific investigation on child welfare in the state of Florida, which we also discussed this hour. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.